I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, live from Baghdad. I want to begin today's program on the very spot where I stood 6 months ago, on the steps of Iraq's National Library. At that time, all the collections of books and archives, the history of Iraq, had been looted and smoke still rolled out of the windows from the fire set by vandals. Now, half a year later, the Director General of the Library, Kamal Jawad, stands forlornly on these same steps. The lapels and the cuffs of his rust-colored tweed coat are frayed and marked with soot.
Okay, we are very sad. All the staff of the library, very sad. And some of them began to weep about the books and the archives which they destroyed.
An Irish aid group helped move the melted photocopiers out by the front door and sweep away the ashes and debris from inside. People from the Library of Congress in America have been offering money and help in rebuilding the collection. But Kamal says so much is gone, he doesn't know where to begin.
We tried to buy all the books we lost, and the archives if we find in another place or in another
office. Street.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Kamal walks me inside the blackened shell of the building.
You know, the last time I was here was 6 months ago.
Yes.
And the library at that time was still smoking. This place where we're standing now, it was still, you could feel the heat from the fire.
Yes.
And when you came to the library for the first time,
yes,
what were you thinking?
Yes, what I think? I am very sad. This is the loss of the history of the Iraq. This is the history of Iraq here. We lost all the
history.
Yes.
Do you know now how much was burned and how much was stolen?
Yes, I think 50.
50% was stolen,
yes.
And the rest was burned?
Yes.
Were you able to get any of the stolen goods back, any of the valuable books?
Yes, we think we shall return all the books which stole to buy all the books we see in the street or in the bookshops. Some of people told me they saw some books in the many places.
And does that mean that you have to buy them?
Yes, I decided to go to the same place and to buy the books.
It's so sad that you have to pay money for books that belong to you.
What do we do?
There's no respect right now. Because there is no authority. There is no local government that have the power to do this. The Americans are not doing anything about it. If you go to these people, maybe they will shoot you, like an AK or anything.
Kamal leads me up the suspended stone staircase in the library's atrium. Today it rises to the second and third floors like a charred fishbone. He walks me across the cracked tiles to a wall where one of his colleagues has scratched a message in Arabic through the soot into the white of the plaster. The words read, "Hulagu Khan has returned and knocked on our door once again." It is a chilling reference to a time 750 years ago when the grandson of Genghis Khan sacked Baghdad. The Mongolian warriors killed 800,000 people here and threw all the books in the city into the Tigris. Baghdadis still talk of that event with horror. They say the river first ran blue with the ink of all the books and then red with the blood of their ancestors. I ask Kamal if there's one book that he thinks about, one book which he considers perhaps the nation's greatest loss. It is the library's 15th century copy of The Canon of Medicine, written by the Bukhara philosopher and doctor Ibn Sina. It was priceless, says Kamal. He says he doesn't even know if it was stolen or burned. Earlier today, I went to the bookseller street in Baghdad, this being a Friday, prayer day during the holy month of Ramadan. Thousands of people were wandering down Mutanabi Street past the bookshops, peering in at old, worn leather Qurans and meeting their friends. At one end of the street, I find Mohammed Dahash. He works with his brother in a shop that sells some very old books.
It is now Ramadan, you know, and the books is good for Ramadan. Yes. So suit for Ramadan.
People buy a lot of books at Ramadan time?
Yes, more than before Ramadan and after Ramadan.
So it's a good time for business.
Yes.
I want to ask you about some old books.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was visiting the National Library.
Oh.
And it's a very sad place.
Very
you know
sad.
That.
We lose it.
And many books burned, many books stolen.
Yes. And many books go out of borders.
Mohammed turns and lifts an enormous worn gray binder off the floor.
"1928 magazine in Iraq. It is now not exist everywhere, just we have it. And we will take it to our home."
Where did it come from?
We buy it from some local libraries. Special libraries, I mean.
But Mohammed,
yes.
Somebody could come in here and see this book and say, "Oh, this book came from the National Library." No?
The government libraries all have stamp.
And this book has no stamp?
Has no stamp. You see.
So you know when you buy it that it's not stolen?
Yes, not stolen. And the people that give us rare things, we take their names, their addresses, and say them if there is any that belong to any people, we will say they buy it to us. We don't have right of this.
But you have to be careful now.
Yes, too much. We must be careful.
So they come here with a book, and how much do they say? They want 5,000 dinars?
No, dollar. Dollar, hundreds of dollars sometimes.
Hundreds of dollars?
Yes, the good books, especially old books, are very expensive. And cost a lot of money.
But will somebody buy those books, Mohammed?
Yes. Somebody and take it out of borders, out of Iraq.
That's what worries you, is that these books are leaving Iraq.
Yes. There is no government in our country could afford the expenses of buying these books again.
So?
We lose.
They're gone.
They're gone.
And does the memory of the country go at
the same time? Yes. All the memory completely gone out of Iraq. Yes.
And when you think about this, how does it make you feel?
It's killing.
It's killing?
Yes. Killing, painful, very painful. Yes. The next generations, they will find nothing here. They will do not know anything about their history, modern history, I mean, especially modern history, because the old history exists in Saudi, exists in Syria, but modern history of Iraq, completely from the 18th century up to now, disappeared completely.
Then I have an idea. It occurs to me to ask Mohammed if he knows about the book mentioned by Kamal at the library, The Canon of Medicine, by the Bukhara philosopher Ibn Sina. He turns to ask his brother.
The old edition of this book, it was in the National Library. Some people, we know him, buy it 50,000 dinar.
50,000 dinars?
And he will take it. Nothing.
So he paid 50,000 dinars?
Yes.
How much is that in dollars?
$25.
$25?
Yes.
The thief had no idea what.
No. Maybe buy it just $1.
The bookseller who's rumored to hold that treasured canon of medicine was, however, nowhere to be found today. But it is just this idea of such an open market which frightens those pledged to protect the pieces of the past. Today in our Baghdad studio, two senior archaeologists here to answer your questions about what went wrong and what's being done now to retrieve what was lost. So, what really is missing? What do we know now about the thieves and the locations of those books and artifacts? More to the point, who's responsible for helping rebuild Iraq's cultural memory? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We also invite you to our website to see the latest pictures from the National Library and the people interviewed on today's program. With me here in Baghdad is John Russell. He is professor of archaeology from the Massachusetts College of Art, but he's currently here as an advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority and Iraq's Ministry of Culture. John, nice to have you here.
Thanks.
And Donnie George is with us as well. He is one of Iraq's top-ranking archaeologists, having worked on dozens of digs around the country. He has just been appointed Director General of Iraq's Museums. And Donnie, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm interested to know, when you listen to the story of the National Museum, which is one of your sister institutions, do you get as depressed as I do listening to that?
Yes, of course. I do have back in memory. I just flash back what happened into the museum itself, so... It's a tragedy, really. I feel this tragedy every moment, yeah.
John, you were saying that the U.S. Library of Congress has just done a survey at the library. What's the sort of executive summary of their conclusion? Can they help? Will they help?
They're committed to help. Their report has still not been written and cleared, and I don't want to anticipate their conclusions, but I did accompany the group, and things were both worse and better than we had expected. There will be a number of surprises. The good news is that the regular collections of books are not nearly so badly damaged as was expected. The bad news is that the archives, many archives were lost, and in fact the main fire was concentrated in the areas of archives, not where the books were.
Speaking of good news, you have some good news from the museum, Donnie. Do you want to share that with us?
Oh, yes. Just 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, I had the news from the coalition forces MPs that are working with us, and the it's a group with the MPs and the Iraqi police, and the captain called me at home and said that they have the Basitki statue. This is one of the major objects that were stolen from the museum. The next day we had
describe it for me so I can put it in my mind.
Yeah, it's an Akkadian statue. Made of bronze, and it goes back to about 2,300 years B.C. And it was found in a village called Basitki between Dohuk and Zaho in the north.
Way
of
up Paris. In the north, yeah.
Yeah, and we had it in the museum, and it was one of the masterpieces we had in the museum. And
a statue of a person or an animal?
It's a statue of a lad, a young man sitting on a rounded base. It's made of bronze, and the fascinating thing is that at that time, it was made by the lost wax technique. And unfortunately, the upper part from the belly is missing. And we have the lower part of the young man who's sitting. But even though it's a really a great piece. And we have it back. The next day after he called me, we had it back in the museum. And yesterday I saw the people from the laboratory had cleaned it. It's... perfect as it was.
Even though when they found it, it was wrapped in or smeared with grease and suspended in a septic tank, it is
That's
now
right.
back in its rightful place.
Yeah.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Your opportunity to speak directly live to guests in our Baghdad studio about exactly what's happening with the recovery of the lost antiquities in this country. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We are live from Baghdad.
Support for
Gordon, you're listening to The Connection live from Baghdad. 6 months ago, our program reported on the smashing and looting of Iraq's National Museum. At that time, we heard Iraq's former director general in charge of antiquities, Muad Damerji, in near tears over what he thought had been lost.
What was lost is the history of mankind, the cultural history of mankind in Iraq, which is, as you know, Iraq is always have been called as the cradle of civilization. We have objects here from the first stone implements which have been made by a kind of man dated in 500,000 BC. We have the oldest objects from 9th millennium BC, so that's 11,000 years old. You will see it when you go there, how big the catastrophe is.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection. We are live in Baghdad. We are taking your calls from our studio here. With me, Donnie George, just taken on the job of Director General of Iraq's Museums, one of the top archaeologists in this country. John Russell is also an archaeologist, a professor of that at the Massachusetts College of Art, and currently here in Iraq as an advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority and deputy senior advisor to Iraq's Ministry of Culture. So let's talk a little bit, if we can, about just exactly what was lost, because you both know in the weeks after, when the curators got back into the museum, there was this, oh, this didn't go, and oh, maybe this wasn't stolen, and there were so then many suspicious reports. Well, was much really stolen? What do we know now? Donnie, do you want to start?
Well, yes. I just want to explain something. I was asked at the very first days, and this was a big mistake taken. I was asked that what's the volume of the material we have in the Iraq Museum? I said we have over 170,000 pieces, and we have subnumbers. So by mistake, it was taken as over 170,000 pieces are missing from the Iraq Museum. So this was something like a misunderstanding. But now we know that around 14,000 pieces were stolen from the museum. This includes some masterpieces from the galleries because they were left there, either they were heavy or they were fragile, so they were not taken. But our people had taken away all the small objects from the showcases or any kind of object that they could. They were evacuated sometime before the war started. So almost all that collection is quite okay.
So what's missing now? Is it the 14,000 or has half of that come back? Where are we today?
Well, the 14,000, that was the number when we started assessing the material. But now we have about 3,000 pieces back into our museum. And I learned that there are something like 1,000 pieces seized in the United States in some airports. And there are something almost 1,000 pieces also were seized in Jordan by the Jordanian borders police. And some here and there in Europe, about 500 pieces in France and some bits here and there.
So we're down to 7,000 or 8,000 pieces that are still missing, still
something
in the black
like
market
that,
somewhere.
Something like that. Some are still in Iraq, and we believe some of them are out somewhere in the world, yeah.
John Russell, you were with me on the program 6 months ago and heard at that time that just the fury in people's voices that the American soldiers had stood by while the looters went in, and rather than go back and pick through the details of that, what can you tell me about the way that's been reviewed? Do we know anything about the Army looking at what went wrong? Are they talking about that?
I think that most people have agreed that it would be best to put that behind us, that most of us weren't there at the time. The people who were knew that it wasn't safe to be guarding the door of the museum while they were being shot at. I mean, it was a battle situation. A lot of the reason for the fury was that initial impression, which Donnie talked about, that everything was gone, when in fact the museum staff had done their jobs, they'd hidden things away. The collection had been as protected as well as it could be. So feeling was that the military did what, I think the current feeling, the military did what they could with the people they had on hand.
But they didn't have enough people on hand to do what they should have done. I mean, Donnie, when I'm on the street today, 6 months later, people say what they did back then. They say, oh yeah, sure, they came in, they put a tank in front of the oil ministry, and everything else was a free-for-all. You must hear this as well.
Well, that's right, yes. Yeah.
And yeah. This, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say, contributes to some of the anger that exists against the Americans today. Would you not agree?
Well, it is that way, but I would say something for this. I would love to say something,
yeah.
Because, you see, it's we can't just stop and start blaming and recalling everything. Now, the damage has done. Now we need to work together to try to recover everything. Recovering these things is now the main task for everybody, for the Iraqi specialists, for the Americans that are helping us, for all the archaeologists in the world to help us to recover these objects and to bring back the Iraq Museum and the system of the Iraqi Antiquities State Board of Antiquities back to action. And for this, we are having a lot of help and a lot of support from everywhere. So this is what we should think about now, and not just stand and start, you know, just stay blaming what had happened. Well, the damage had done. It's finished. Now we have to work to recover everything. So, and we are working together, which I believe this is the best thing to do.
We're having a little bit of difficulty with our satellite transmission right now, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand things over to Gail Harris, who's standing by in our Boston studio, and Lauren Sandler, who's a New York-based journalist investigating issues of cultural heritage in Iraq, and we'll reestablish communication with Boston. Gail, over to you.
Thanks, Dick. Appreciate hearing from you, and we're going to check in with Lauren. Lauren, as you've been listening so far, and I know you've been doing some work on the psychology of looting, and I wonder what you found.
Well, you know, it's quite troubling to think not just about the things that have been stolen, but the things that were destroyed. I just came back somewhat recently from a couple months spent in Iraq, and it's really bringing me back to listen to Dick's report into the conversation. And I went there really thinking a lot about what had been stolen, what was moving out to Jordan, how things were being trafficked, and to discover how many statues had been smashed and not just taken out of the museum for sale was something that really startled me. Dick's report about the library, of course, probably conveys this as much as anything. And that's something that I really started looking into while I was over there. I mean, you can really understand people who have been living in poverty, you know, finally having an opportunity to get their hands on something that many of them believe is rightly theirs. But to burn down a library is, of course, a very different thing. And one thing that people would tell me over and over in Iraq is that Saddam had his name on everything. Saddam, you know, famously said over and over, Saddam is Iraq and Iraq is Saddam. And he so effectively branded the culture of Iraq. He so effectively, you know, convinced people of his own ownership of every library and every museum that, you know, there's a sociologist who described the whole situation to me as a voodoo doll. If you want to hurt someone, you take something which is a representation of them, and you destroy that. Well, it seems like that's what people did with many of the cultural centers of Iraq.
Okay, Lauren, thank you so much for that. We're going to be asking you to stand by, but right now we're ready to go back to Dick in Baghdad. Dick.
Thanks very much, Gail. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. Join us in our live broadcast from the capital city of Iraq as we talk about the still missing treasures of this country. With me in the studio, Donnie George and John Russell, and we're happy to take your calls on the subject that we're discussing today. You know, one of the things that we haven't talked about, and I don't know, Donnie or John, who's best to answer this, but are we any closer to knowing who took the material? I mean, there were so many claims at the time that, oh, it was foreigners, it was experts, it was locals. What do we know now?
As far as I can tell, the pieces that are turning up just the way you'd expect them to be. People who've been visiting Iraq, bringing back souvenirs, thugs and criminals who might be smuggling a number of things, including guns, taking on antiquities as a sideline, brother of somebody, the cousin of somebody.
But these guys were good, Donnie. Any idea that there were insiders saying, go here, that it might have been something that was professionally planned?
Well, from the evidences that we had, I believe there were some pretty well knew what they wanted. Because I've been always saying, first we found glass cutters in the museum, so this means that they were prepared to go into the museum and cut the glass showcases that we had. And they had good knowledge of archaeology because they passed by some gypsum replicas in the museum. They never touched them.
But were these Iraqis?
Well, as far as we know, yes, they were Iraqis, but maybe they had good knowledge of everything. And they had, I would say they had some orders maybe from some place, we don't know, because it proves now that the objects are appearing now in Europe and the States. So this means they had connections.
Yeah, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Providence, Rhode Island. David's on the line. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. When all of this began happening and it hit the media, there was a lot of speculation about an intentional effort on the part of the United States to allow the museums to be left unprotected. I know you've been speaking a bit about that, tanks left in front of certain ministries and museums apparently left unprotected. Is there a lingering sense that this was part of a concerted effort to demoralize an enemy in the process of taking over the country?
Does anybody talk about that here? I haven't actually heard that in Iraq. I know it's talked about elsewhere, that maybe this was meant to happen as a tactic to demoralize people?
Well, some people talked about this, yes, in Iraq, because the looting of the museum actually hit them in the heart, you know, and everybody felt it was a great loss for the people of Iraq. So they started talking about this. Yes, they say, well, it might have been just a plan that just to hit the people in the heart and just to lose their history and evidences for their history.
Pretty harsh judgment, though.
Some people, I heard people talking about this, so I don't know.
You heard this, John?
Of course, it was easy to think that at the time, but I think in retrospect that's giving the Americans more credit for conniving than they deserved. It was really an issue of not enough troops on the ground to both fight the war and protect the buildings. Kind of bad luck in a way that the oil ministry was the only building that got protected, because it made it easy to point fingers, but it was kind of lucky the oil ministry got protected. I mean,
let's go back to David in Providence. What do you think, David? Are you there?
Yes, I'm still here. Thank you for those wonderful answers. The second part of the question is that, do you think that the nature of these horrible crimes, which are actually crimes against humanity in general, I mean, the history of the human race is everyone's inheritance, and all of our inheritance has been, you know, sorely lessened because of what has occurred. Do you think it will inform the activity of future military operations? I mean, there will be future military operations. I don't think we'll evolve so quickly that this will disappear
overnight.
David,
I've lost you there. I'm sorry if you're still speaking. I'm not getting the return from Providence, so forgive me if I'm speaking over what you're saying. I want to actually turn to something, Donnie, that you and I have spoken about before, and that is that journalists themselves carry some responsibility for the carting off of Iraq's antiquities. This is something a point that you wanted to make.
Well, yes, exactly on the 27th of April, me and Dr. John Curtis from the British Museum, we were traveling from Iraq to London. We had a very important meeting on the 29th in London. And while we were at the Jordanian borders, I learned from the man who was in charge of the security there that until that date, that was the 27th of April, they have captured 12 cases of journalists smuggling antiquities. 12 cases of journalists smuggling antiquities and some documents, but most of them antiquities. And I was surprised so much because we had a lot of journalists in the museum, and we loved to have them there, and they were our voices to the world. But I was really shocked when I heard that the journalists were the ones who were smuggling our antiquities outside the country. And this was a fact. And 3 days after I finished I was coming back after 3 days. And the day I was at the Jordanian borders, there was again another case. At that moment, also another journalist smuggling antiquities. Yeah, and that was a very, very bad thing to happen.
We're getting a lot of static in our earphones. John, if you want to just slide one back, maybe you can hear me a little more clearly. But what's being done now to secure the archaeological sites in Iraq? I gather that a number of them are under the control of the Department of Defense?
Sadly, no. Two are. The site of Ur, which is next to the major Talil Air Base.
And that's the one I read about, yeah.
And the site of Babylon, of course, has military presence on it as well. Most sites that aren't that don't happen to be on American military bases are just being left to their left by themselves. And recent aerial photos that I saw that the Italian Carabinieri had taken over Dikar province, which is south of Babylon, showed devastation on a scale that I would never have expected possible.
What do you mean by devastation?
Entire large cities, Umm al-Akarib, which was a city that Donnie was digging at.
Right, I remember
prior
that story.
To the war. Umm, just north of there. Sites that had some looting prior to this war, but that had been under control, have now, you can see the size of the sites by looking at the pits, and pits that are meters and meters across on top of one another, so that from the air you can see that the whole city has been destroyed. And this is a dozen or more cities where you see this kind of destruction. So it's a serious problem, and the military, again, don't have enough people to patrol sites. It's not their job. And
whose job would it be if not the military?
Nobody's taken on the job. So the Coalition Provisional Authority and the Ministry of Culture are now working on a project that will provide training, communication, and vehicles in coordination with the Antiquities Department to give the guards who are out there, and there are 1,500 guards out there on these sites, a sort of fighting chance, a chance to call in the army, the cavalry, the police, whoever, when a group of looters comes to one of these sites.
Donnie, is this just a matter of paying people to do it? I mean, you would think there would be Iraqis who would all be interested in protecting the sites.
Well, it's not the matter of paying now. You see, we have, for instance, in that Umm al-Akarib site, I had then about 15 guards, but when we left, we had 10 guards there. But what would 10 guards do against 200 or 300 armed men that come and dig on that site?
And that's how bad it is.
Exactly. And what we are seeking is that we need those guards to come back to their positions. But the most important thing is that they have communication with the coalition forces there, and they would have backups immediately when there's a kind of attack on these sites.
I have to stop you there. We're going to take a short break. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection, live from Baghdad. Live from Baghdad, this is The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon, and this is your opportunity to speak directly with the people who are working on issues of cultural heritage here. Donnie George is Director General of Iraq's Museums. John Russell, an archaeologist from the Mass College of Art, is currently in Iraq as an advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority. Straight to the phones now. Paul's on the line from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Hello, gentlemen. I just wanted to ask, is there any evidence that Saddam Hussein, at the outbreak of the war, either he or his higher-ups snatched any of that stuff and either hid it or maybe took it out of the country? And what percent of what's missing do they think might have happened that way?
So, senior officials of the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein, his sons, any idea that they would have had access to this material?
I don't know, really, but I will tell you a story of some people that have been working in the central bank. There were two men, that they were responsible for the main vault that our gold material was hidden there.
This is archaeological gold material, not just bar.
No, archaeological material that was put in the central bank since 1990.
Okay.
So the people heard about Qusay, one of his sons, that had come and taken a lot of money. Before the war, before the American forces were into Baghdad. So they were afraid that they might have some pressure to open the vaults for them. What they did, they took their families and flew away in the countryside and disappeared.
With the gold?
No, with their keys. Because because they should be both together there,
yes,
to open these vaults. So they flew away, everyone in some parts, I don't know, somewhere. in the countryside, so that they won't find them, they won't bring them together to open the vaults for, if there were a case that they would put pressure on them to open this. But other than that, I don't know any case, really.
Yeah. Okay, Paul, thanks a lot for your call. I guess I'm not too aware, John, of exactly how sophisticated the investigations are in searching out what's missing, what's been already taken abroad. I mean, Interpol is involved, and I know there are people in Europe and in America who are looking, but once this stuff gets into a private collection, or once this, you know, you get some senior black market person moving it into a private collection, it's pretty hard to track, isn't it?
I assume so. You figure that things that have made it into collections will surface when that owner dies or donates it or something like that. The law enforcement efforts have been pretty sophisticated. I've been impressed. A large percentage of the thousands of stolen things have been scanned into a database and are available at Interpol. And in fact, we were using that today to identify some cylinder seals that were seized. This was a report that was in the Globe, I think, a couple of months ago, a reporter coming in with seals seized at Newark. And it's possible using the database to identify those things.
Cylinder seals are the little sort of roll of quarter size ways that people sign their name.
That's right.
Yeah.
They carved their name on it and then rolled it in clay?
Well, more than names, pictures, gorgeous pictures. It's the most monumental, beautiful art of the ancient Near East is this jewel-sized, these small gems carved with elaborate scenes, and they also bring the highest prices of any Near Eastern art.
And so, sadly enough, Donnie, these are also ones that are the easiest to smuggle because you can carry them in your pockets.
Exactly. When we've had about 5,000 pieces of those lost from the storerooms of the museum.
Still gone?
Yes. We found some of them, but not all of them. You know, a large collection of these were missing from the storerooms in the museum. Yeah.
Let's go back to our phones. Cambridge, Massachusetts. Elizabeth's joining us now. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for airing this important show. I'm curious, Donnie, how the Iraqi people are being informed about the losses on archaeological sites and the progress that you're making in the museums and other cultural sites.
You mean how is the information getting to the general public?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking, Elizabeth?
Yes.
Well, we almost every day we have Iraqi journalists in the museum, and they are following, I would say, day by day what's happening in the museum and what objects are coming back, because it is really a great concern of the Iraqi people, the museum. I was myself, to tell you the truth, at the very beginning, I was surprised because everybody from a grocer, from a shop, small shop that I buy fruit, to a professor in the university, everybody was aware and everybody was hit in the heart of what happened to the museum. So we have almost daily information flowing through the newspapers, Iraqi newspapers, for these people, and sometimes, of course, we do have the Iraqi television and Iraqi radios also coming to us. So they are informed, I would say, daily what's happening and what objects are coming back.
Do you think, Elizabeth, that there's enough coverage of this in America? Are you seeing this story on a regular basis as well?
No, I don't. I think that the issue of cultural heritage in Iraq and really anywhere in the world isn't considered important enough to cover, even though it defines the people. And when that is lost, something very important is lost about a people. And there's no sense of urgency in this administration, I don't think, that understands that attacking a people's culture or allowing it to be looted is, as Donnie says, attacking the heart of the people that you're trying to get on your side.
But, John, it's so much more than that. I mean, you're an archaeologist who has studied what's here. This isn't Iraq's heritage. This is all of our heritage, isn't it?
Well, that's why I kept breaking down into tears last spring when I thought it was worse than it turned out to be in the museum, and why I'm afraid I did it again when I saw those satellite photos. We came from those cities. It's those cities that are now churned up into rubble and craters define us as human beings still.
And yet, you know, on a day when six American soldiers are killed in the crash of a Black Hawk helicopter, stories like this don't get the attention that, you know, they get pushed away. I'm not saying one story is more important than the other. That would be ridiculous. But, you know, while the fighting goes on, some of this isn't being talked about, I suppose, Donnie.
Well, I think the American people have the right to know everything what's happening here, because they have their people here as people in the army, and they have a lot of people doing other things here, helping the Iraqi people. So they should know exactly what's happening on all the sides, you see, on the cultural sides and other things. And I believe it's a very important issue that they are kept informed of what's happening here.
We're going back to our phones. Caroline's on the line. She's calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Caroline. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for this program. Nothing angered me more than what happened to those two institutions and the failure to protect them. And I just believe that a part of that $85 million just approved in Congress to rebuild...
That's billion, Caroline.
$85 billion. What? Billion, I said, didn't I? The part of that money should go to helping to recover these objects and to rebuilding those two institutions to bring them back to what they were, to hold, you know, whatever is recovered, which hopefully will be as much as possible.
Just stay with me, because John's in a position to, you know, talk at least in general terms, John, about how much of that money is going to be used to help. You're giving advice to both sides almost as a liaison between. What can you tell us?
First, I want to say that we weep when helicopters crash, too, unfortunately. We're going to make sure that the funds that are necessary to get the museum up and running and the library up and running are found. It won't be $85 billion. That won't be necessary. But there is money available from the State Department, from private organizations, from UNESCO, and I believe that it will be sufficient to the task. The real job is to, in a country where it's still difficult to get things done, where communication is a problem, to get the experts to come in. Who wants to come to Baghdad now? That's why the State Department team who came to assess the museum, the Library of Congress team, are heroes, I think, because they came, they told us what we needed to be doing, and we're going to do our best to do it in conjunction with Dr. Kamel and Donnie and our colleagues.
And it's starting, Donnie. You're seeing some air conditioning contractors tomorrow at the museum, am I right?
Well, yes, we're having some contractors there to see the equipment there and how to, just to repair these things so that we'll have our air conditioning system back. And it's not only that, we have programs for security system. We have programs for to refurbish, just to renew the doors and paint the rooms, and just bring the building back as it was, and to all the equipments to start working so that we can go back in full action.
And I want to say that the building that we identified for the new National Library, the old one's too badly burned. When it's finished, and we expect to be able to do that in fairly short order, will be absolutely the most spectacular library in the Middle East. It's an incredible building. It was originally a Baathi officers'
club. Yeah.
And it's just a gorgeous place.
Back to the phones now. Steve's on the line from Cape Cod. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a shame. As we listen to this story, we're hearing all the wonderful things that the Americans are doing in conjunction with the Iraqis to protect these antiquities. But at the same time, I think that the Americans are getting blamed for a lot of what happened, in the sense, the looters were Iraqi, and we've heard explained very, very eloquently why they did it and why they directed their hate at some of these institutions, because they represented Saddam Hussein. But I think we ought to be commending these Americans that are over there working together with the Iraqis to put this back together, because I don't think anybody would have chose to see it happen this way, but people's lives were at stake in a war zone, and can you imagine what the story would have been if American soldiers died protecting statues?
Well, I would say something. I myself and some of my colleagues were in the museum, and we were ready to lose our life to protect it. It's not just a statue or two. These are pieces representing the history of mankind. So I would love to stress in this. This is one thing. And, of course, now we are working together, and I think we have very good connections with everybody to rebuild the museum and to have the objects back and to open the museum and to show it to public. I mean, it will be open to everybody and because it's the heritage of mankind. It's not just Iraqis' heritage. It's the heritage of mankind that was in that museum. I always say, if you go to that museum, you will witness the heritage and the history of mankind, starting from about 500,000 years till the beginning of the last century. So it is actually one of the most important museums in the world. And
Steve,
that's
quick last,
the main point.
Quick last comment from you, Steve.
Need assistance?
Nope, Steve is not there. You know what I was thinking as you were talking about the statue and the statue of Basitki and Donnie was, can you ever imagine a time in Iraq when a statue of Saddam Hussein stands in a museum as a memory of this time?
Well, it's a part of history. To tell you the truth, in the storerooms in the museum, we have a statue of two statues for Abdul Karim Qasim when he first started the revolution in 1958. So keeping one or two of these statues, it's a part of history. I mean, whether it's a positive or negative history, but it is a part of history.
Have you got one tucked away somewhere?
Not yet, but we'll have some, maybe.
There are some really gross heads on the top of the palace that we're going to save one of. They're 40 feet tall, so he'll be commemorated.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us on the program today. Donnie George, it was great to have you in.
Thank you very much.
And John Russell, nice to have you here. John Russell, an archaeologist from the Mass College of Art, and Donnie George, Director General of Iraq's Museums. Thanks also to Lauren Sandler for helping fill in on the program today. You're listening to The Connection. We are broadcasting this week and all next week live from Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon.